From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Of course, a lot has been written about the terror of the Nazi concentration camps by survivors, historians, scholars. But Nikolaus Waxman says more than 80 years after the first Nazi camp was established, there was still no comprehensive history. And so, in a sweeping and almost overwhelming book, he explores the camps, putting them into a political and cultural context, explaining how they were designed, and more importantly, what it was like to be a prisoner in one. Today in the program, Professor Waxman is joining us to explain how these camps belonged to a wider web of the Nazi regime, because he says the terror inside those camps can only be fully understood by looking outside the barbed wire. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar and historian Nikolaus Waxman has recently released an extraordinary account of the Nazi concentration camps. He traces the camps from their beginnings in 1933 to their end almost exactly 70 years ago in 1945. And what's unique about Waxman's book is its scope, the first full account of the camp system, full profiles of the leaders and guards, but also, of course, what it was like to live in a camp like this from day to day. Waxman says because some have described these prisoners at the end of the war as blank automatons drained of all free will, it's easy to see them as objects of Nazi terror. But Waxman instead sees them as actors in a much larger story and a much more complicated web of terror. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his book. It's called KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. We invite you to join the conversation if you have your own comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Nikolaus Waxman is a professor of modern European history at Birkbeck College, the University of London. And he's joining us today from the studios of the BBC in Liverpool. And Professor Waxman, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin with something you write early on in the book. You say that the popular images of Nazi concentration camps can be one-dimensional. We see broad brushstrokes, you write, and vivid colors. Explain that a little. What do you think the general impression is before we get to the particulars?
Well, I think in many ways, when people think about the concentration camps, the images they have in their mind are the images which were taken by the liberators in spring 1945 when they arrived at the camps. These are the images which were then published in news magazines and newspapers in the US and elsewhere and were shown in newsreels and so on. And these are images of utter devastation and destruction and mountains of bodies and corpses everywhere. And of course, that is a snapshot of the camp system right at the end. But what these images don't transport is the fact that the camp system a few years earlier would have looked very different. And a camp in 1945 and liberation bears almost no resemblance to a camp set up in 1933. I think there's also this sense that there is a typical camp when in fact there isn't a typical camp. Right. Camps came in all sorts of shapes and sizes, and there was a huge difference when you were held in a camp, what camp you were held in, and I think the story is a lot more complicated than people realize often.
More than 80 years after the first concentration camp was established, Dachau, which we'll get to, No single account of the KL. When did that occur to you, and why do you figure that is?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I've worked on Nazi terror for many years, and it was during this work that it struck me at some stage that though there was a huge amount of scholarly literature, of memoirs and so on, dealing with specific aspects of the camp system, I mean, there are massive encyclopedias as well, there was no one book which tried to pull this whole story together and tell the history of the camp system, its development, why it was set up, but most importantly of the people inside, those who suffered the camps and those who staffed the camps from beginning to end. And that's what I try to do in this book.
Do you, when you first took this on, trying to tell, make a comprehensive an account of all of this, did you think it was possible? I mean, were there moments when you figured it can't be done?
I did kind of sometimes go up to my study and, you know, read through the mountains of documents which I assembled over the years. And there are moments where you're not sure how you're going to be able to tell this story. I mean, one of the great challenges in a sense of a project like this is to try and make this story accessible and real. What I didn't want to do was to tell this as a purely abstract story of the development of the system full of statistics and anonymous actors. I wanted to try and tell this really through the eyes of those who suffered the camps and those who staffed the camps, and also those who looked into the camps from the outside, of whom there were many more people than one might think, and trying to access these sources. I mean, this meant trying to collate a large number of testimonies by survivors, also by prisoners who didn't survive but left notes and so on. I mean, it's not many people, I think, know that some of the Jewish prisoners who worked at the gas chambers in Auschwitz were forced to work there by the SS at threat of death, wrote notes which they buried near the crematoria and the gas chamber, and some of these notes were found after the war. So it was a question for me to try and pull as many of these different sources and testimonies together to get a sense of what the camps felt like for those who were inside.
I think what I also wanted to mention about the book is it is story-based. Every large issue you try to explore, for example, is based on, it is portrayed, conveyed in a story. I mean, it goes from one story to the next. So in some ways, it seems, it doesn't at all seem like a textbook, for example. It seems almost more like a novel in that way.
Well, it kind of that's nice to hear, in the sense that that was one of the aims I had when I tried to think about how I read history and what got me into history in the first place before I became a professional historian. Then it was the stories and the individuals of those who make the histories. And what I tried to do in the book is, on the one hand, of course, explain why this happened, and trace the development of this system, which is an extraordinary trajectory, which nobody could have foreseen when the first camps were set up. Yeah. So there is explanation, analysis, but at the same time, I try to link this to individual stories to make it come alive, in a sense. Yeah. So each major chapter starts with a case study of you know, a particular significant moment in the camp, and I really try to go down as far as that is possible into the camps at that very moment in time to give a sense of what it would have been like.
Auschwitz comes up for most people. That the images, of course, tend to dominate this picture, I guess. You point out, though, early on that this wasn't always so, that Auschwitz used to be seen just as one place of suffering among many. And I think this is, I wanted to mention this because this is one of the points you make in the book, is I think there are a lot of misimpressions about the camps and the trajectory of the story. Auschwitz, you say, never was synonymous, for example, with the Nazi concentration camps, even though it was the most notorious and was the most lethal by far.
That's absolutely right. I mean, Auschwitz is a relatively late addition to the concentration camp system. I mean, overall, during the period of the Third Reich, the SS or the Nazi regime sets up some 27 concentration camps, and you have more than a 1,000 attached satellite camps all across occupied Nazi Europe. Now, by the time Auschwitz is set up in 1940, the first SS camp at Dachau had already been operating for more than 7 years. And a lot of what the SS, in a sense, tried and invented in Dachau then finds its way into camps like Auschwitz. I mean, this goes for the staffing, to the rules, to the regulations, and indeed the personnel itself. I mean, the first commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Höss, trains as an SS man in Dachau in 1934. So there is much more to the camp system than Auschwitz equally, and I think that is a really important distinction to make as well. I mean, I think in the popular mind, Auschwitz is not just seen as synonymous with the camp system, but also with the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And it is, of course, important to stress that Auschwitz is the single most deadly place in the Holocaust. Nowhere else are more Jews killed in one single place than in Auschwitz. About 1 million or so Jews die at the hands of the SS in Auschwitz. But 5 million or so Jews die elsewhere. Right. They are murdered in, shot in ditches, in forests and fields across Eastern Europe, or they are murdered in distinct death camps like Treblinka in Eastern Europe. And that's an important distinction, because these death camps, pure death camps like Treblinka, are set up for one purpose only, and that is to kill as many Jews as quickly as possible. The almost all Jews who arrive in these pure death camps like Treblinka are murdered within hours of arrival. A site like Auschwitz always has multiple functions. So these concentration camps function as extermination camps in part, but also as sites for forced labor, as sites for destroying the political opposition, as sites for locking away social outsiders, religious dissidents, as sites for medical experiments, and so on. Mm. So the concentration camps are multi-purpose institutions all the way through the Third Reich. And crucially, these functions change over time.
I wanted to establish some context that you write about early on. You write about this film that was shown, one particular showing, April of 1941. And part of the film, as you say, is set against the backdrop of a concentration camp. But the villains, importantly, here in this film that the Germans were watching in April of 1941 weren't Germans, of course. They were British imperialists. Explain this, if you would, because this is an important bit of context. The Nazis always said we weren't the first to do concentration camps, and we weren't the first to have excesses in our concentration camps.
Yeah, I mean, that's an example of one of those stories which hopefully illuminate a broader theme here. The point I'm trying to make here is that sometimes in, you know, Holocaust denier circles, people say, oh, you know, kind of the Nazis weren't the inventors of the concentration camps and so on. There were many concentration camps elsewhere, including the camps set up by the British during the Boer War at the turn of the century, where this term concentration camp comes from. And of course, the Nazis themselves are extremely keen in their propaganda all the way through the Third Reich to stress that, you know, they didn't invent the camps, allegedly. So, I mean, Hitler talks about this in, he rarely refers to concentration camps, it should be said, Hitler. And when he does, he says, you know, we didn't invent them. It was the British who invented them. And this is, of course, done to legitimate the camps, to say these are not extraordinary, unusual institutions. But if you drill down further, I think it becomes quite clear that only because these British camps or other colonial camps had been called concentration camps doesn't mean that they're in any way linked or identical even to the Nazi camps. When the Nazis come to power in 1933, they still have to invent the concentration camp, their version of the concentration camp. They have no idea what these camps are going to look like, who's going to staff them, how people are going to be treated in there. And they don't even know if these camps are going to be permanent additions to the disciplinary landscape or not. There is a real moment, in a very significant moment, in the kind of about a year or two after the Nazis come to power, where the regime seriously considers abolishing the concentration camps as far as they exist. And, you know, that's one of these other stories which I think few people are aware of. I mean, there is no Nazi master plan for the camps.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as if they come to power and know exactly what they want to do. Quite the contrary. The camps are set up in 1933. There was a lot of improvisation and chaos, effectively. The main purpose of the camps is to destroy the political opposition. So the vast majority of prisoners in the early camps are political prisoners, above all communists. Once the political opposition is broken, it's not quite clear if the regime needs these camps still. And there are high-level discussions at the top of the Nazi state in 1934-35 about whether they still need the camps or whether they shouldn't just simply rely on authoritarian law and prisons, which also serve the ends of the regime.
Another theme that I detected along that line was this constant sense of confusion and change. Change, you say, was a constant in the KL system. And it seemed like that you mentioned, and when we get back from a break here in a moment, I want to spend a little bit more time in 1933 and 1934 in Dachau, because these early days seem to set a pattern, a template for a lot of things that went on in the entire system. But you get a sense in those early days, in those conversations about whether we should use the rule of law, whether we should have these camps at all, that it seemed like that at some moment, if something had just turned just a little, there wouldn't have been camps like this. And and who knows what would have happened with Nazism, for example, at certain turning points. I mean, you see these turns, and it's really extraordinary.
Well, I mean, the story in hindsight, if we look at the story, it does seem almost inevitable that we get there. But there are different paths the camps could have taken, or the Nazi terror system could have taken. I think that is an important aspect of this story, too. Equally, I think, important is the fact that these camps don't just, I mean, I think there is also a sense that things just get from worse to worse to worse, and there is a trajectory towards mass extermination in Auschwitz. And actually, there are moments in the camp system where things gradually, temporarily, slightly improve. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of change over time and transformation that has something to do with the function which the regime gives those camps. As the aims of the regime change, the function of the camps change. So in the early period, as I said, the main function is to destroy the political opposition. Later on in the 1930s, the main function, as far as the regime is concerned, of these camps is to eradicate all deviants, everybody who doesn't fit into this new Nazi national community which the regime is trying to build. So by the time war breaks out, the majority of those inside are not political prisoners, and they are not German Jews, but they are so-called asocials and criminals, beggars, homeless people, and others who've been picked up by the police in mass raids. And then we have more changes in function as well during the war, but maybe we'll come back to that later.
Yeah, we will. Cultural hygiene, that was an important impulse, it seems, for the cultural and racial hygiene, purifying the culture. That was a big impulse that motivated a lot of this, it seems.
Yes, I mean, I kind of think the main person running this, or the main mastermind, if you will, behind this camp system is the SS leader Heinrich Himmler, who unites these camps fairly quickly under his control and sets the overall course for the camp system. And Himmler believes that what Germany needs to embark on is a war against aliens, against kind of so-called racial outsiders, mm-hmm. political outsiders, social outsiders, anybody who doesn't fit into this new Germany. And he envisages a war, an apocalyptic war, which will rage for decades or even centuries. And in this war, the camps will play a central part.
We should mention what KL is. My German is terrible. Konzentrationslager.
That's very good. Yes, it's kind of that was the abbreviation which you find in a lot of the official documents used at the time, KL for Konzentrationslager, concentration camps. And one of the reasons, I mean, there are various reasons why I chose this as the title of my book, but one reason is that it also points to the bureaucracy of terror. I think many people associate the concentration camps with just random violence, with anarchy and constant excesses. And of course, they took place. But at the same time, you also have a bureaucracy of terror behind this. You have forms, documents, staff, offices, and this kind of is parallel to the system of outright terror. I mean, it's extraordinary to think that even in 1944, while thousands of Jewish prisoners in spring and summer are exterminated in Auschwitz every single day, the commandant of Dachau would also write to headquarters in Berlin to ask permission to flog a prisoner. Mm-hmm. So these kind of this bureaucratic side, I think, is also an important part of this world of the camps, if you will. It's actually in some ways strange timing, this interview, because it was only today that a former member of the Auschwitz administration office, a man called Oskar Gröning, went on trial in Germany, in northern Germany, as an accessory for murder. And he'd been involved in the accounting and transfer of valuables and money plundered from Jews in Auschwitz at the height of murder there. So that's another link to the bureaucracy, which stood this huge machine, which involved literally tens of thousands of staff, which ran this system. Mm.
Nikolaus Waxman is joining us, a professor of modern European history at Birkbeck College, University of London, joining us from the studios of the BBC in Liverpool. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Waxman's book is called KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. We'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Nikolaus Waxman is with us to talk about the history of the Nazi concentration camps. His new book is an exhaustive and heartbreaking account of the scope of the Nazi camp system. It's the first real, complete story of this process, from its origins, its development, to the everyday experiences of the inhabitants. Waxman says the camps embodied the spirit of Nazism and the burning obsessions of leadership to create this uniform national community by removing political, social, and, of course, racial outsiders. The book is called KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So you begin the book with these three images of Dachau from three different time periods to just give us a sense of how utterly they change. April of 1945 is the sort of the end point, but you also write about Dachau in 1939, which was different. 1939, for example, was when the terror of the camps was kind of at its most controlled, maybe its most contained. 45, everything had gone off the rails, of course, but you also write about 1933. I wanted to start there because this is where you say this was really the early days. This was before the SS even had taken over the camps. And the guards in these camps, if it's hard to imagine now, I have to say, they weren't Nazi paramilitaries. They were, you describe them as, in some cases, amiable policemen who, you know, chatted with prisoners, even slept in the same buildings.
Well, and ate the same food as the prisoners. And there are kind of some documents by prisoners from that time. I mean, there's one letter I quote in my book at the beginning of a Jewish prisoner who writes to his wife, and I think he says, I'm being treated well here. It's all a bit boring. The only thing I don't know is when I'm going to come home. But he clearly expected to come home very soon. Instead, within a few weeks, he'd been murdered after the SS took the camp over. The reason I stress the beginnings of Dachau early on in the book is because I think it also goes against this image of these huge organized structures which people have when they think about the camp system. When, as I said before, the SS has to, or the Nazi regime has to invent the concentration camps. They do not have a blueprint. And when they set up, when they decide to set up a camp in Dachau near Munich, they take over a disused munitions factory and use one of the buildings there, which is pretty dilapidated and broken down, put some kind of controls around it, but it's all done on the hoof, improvised. And there is no sense here, I think, in the minds of anybody, prisoner or guard, there on that day in March 1933, that this could be the beginning of an enormous system of terror which will strike much of Europe within a few years. Most prisoners and guards, I think, expected this to be over in a matter of weeks. But it's typical, in a sense, for the very, very early terror. I mean, what happens in 1933, the Nazis come to power, and the number one aim in 1933 is to secure the regime, and to do this by destroying any possibility of resistance by democratic forces and by the communists. So what the Nazi paramilitaries do is they set up, and the police force, which also comes into the hand of the Nazis, what they do is to grab any kind of space they can find, like this munitions factory, former munitions factory in Dachau. But they also use ships or sports halls or bars or pubs, whatever they can find, to lock up opponents or suspected opponents of the regime. And one of the things that means is that terror early on is incredibly public. There is this, I mean, you talked before about the misconceptions or myths of the camps. And one of the myths in Germany after the war was that no Germans really knew anything about these camps. Nobody had any idea of really what went on inside. And what is quite clear when you look at the historical record is that even at the beginning in 1933, this terror is incredibly public. In Berlin, the German capital, you have over 170 of these camps set up in, quite often in the house across the street. So passers-by literally witness people being dragged inside these houses. They hear their screams. They see them being dragged out, covered in blood, and so on. So this is incredibly public right from the beginning. And of course, Nazi propaganda also talks about the camps. So this, the myth of the invisible camp is another one that I think we need to explode.
Well, you mentioned that, as you say, the primacy of political power is what gets them started. And this violence sets the dynamic for the future. And among the things that are happening as the SS and the SA start to take over Dachau, for example, and it's, I have to say, it's so interesting to hear you describe the dispute between the SS and, I don't know if they were conventional police forces, but it wasn't always clear whether the SS should be the ones in charge. There was the SS were at times deposed in Dachau, at least I think it was.
Well, it's not in Dachau, but there is another big camp kind of in kind of western northern Germany, run by the Prussian authorities, and there indeed the SS is deposed after a number of incidents involving prisoners and also the local population around the camp. It's by no means a foregone conclusion that the SS will be in charge of this camp system. I mean, if you return to Dachau, an extraordinary thing happens in the summer of 1933. So initially this camp is set up in this munitions factory. Within a matter of weeks, the SS takes over this camp. Within a day or two of the SS taking over, we have the first murders in Dachau. All of them, three Jewish prisoners who were murdered by the SS in April 1933. These are followed by a number of other murders in the early weeks of the SS rule over Dachau. But what happens then in May and June of 1933 is that the state prosecution office picks up on this in Munich and actually files a suit, accuses the charges the commandant of Dachau and some other Dachau officials, and in the end Himmler, the SS leader, is forced to effectively sack the commandant and replace him with somebody else. So there are, extraordinary as this may seem to us now, early on in the regime, even some law cases against violence or atrocities in these camps. And this is, again, kind of part of this story of the regime trying to understand what these camps are and how they should function, what their place will be in this new Germany.
I was intrigued by the story of Theodor Eicher, picked by, and how he was picked by Heinrich Himmler, and the role that he played early in the sort of development of this terror in the camps. Would you mention him? I can't say I've ever heard of him before, but he plays an interesting role in the story.
Well, he's an extraordinary figure, really. I mean, if Himmler is kind of the main mastermind, then Eicher is the manager, yeah, of this SS camp system. And he's a kind of what you might now call an alpha male, a brawler, a fighter, an incredibly brutal, violent, but also charismatic man who manages to bind a lot of the SS core around him, who adore him, who idolize him. They call him Papa, Daddy, Eicher. And he is really the man who, more than anybody else, manages to turn this improvised camp system in something formalized, and invents a kind of order of SS terror. You mentioned the fact of where Himmler finds him. I mean, it exactly links to what we talked about before. Himmler is forced to sack the first commandant of Dachau, and the man he appoints in his place is this man Eicher. And where does he find him? He finds him in a mental asylum, right, where Eicher had been assigned to. But I think we need to be slightly careful here. The reason Eicher ended up there was because of internal disputes typical for Nazi bigwigs falling out with each other. So it was a kind of political intrigue that he ended up there.
But the point you say, though, with Eicher was because Himmler was able to get him out of that system and appoint him to that camp, Eicher had... Himmler had Eicher's loyalty for the rest of his life. It was cemented there.
That's absolutely true. And that is indeed a tactic which Himmler uses again and again and again. Kind of what he does is he gives his most veteran SS men a second chance. And what that does is that they are incredibly loyal and bound to him. And loyalty is my honor. I mean, that is the motto of the SS, and Himmler harps on about this all the time. But I think we need to be careful not to think that, I mean, there is an image of the SS perpetrators as unhinged sadists, mm-hmm, and of course some of them were, but they were in a minority. Most of the perpetrators were motivated by quite different things. It might be careerism, it might be ideology, it might be a belief in this comradeship and this intensely male atmosphere in which, I mean, almost all of the SS prisoners before the war are men. I mean, there's a small women's camp set up towards the end of kind of the last period before the war in Ravensbrück, but the bulk of the staff and the prisoners are men, and what some of these men do is literally to impress each other, yeah, by ever more violent deeds.
And they whip themselves into a frenzy, you describe, from time to time.
They do. I mean, there are occasions when there is this. I mean, there's an extraordinary moment in Buchenwald, one of the new camps, which is designed and set up from the start then as an SS concentration camp with barracks and so on. And what happens in Buchenwald in 1938 is that two prisoners escape, and not only do they escape, but they murder an SS guard. Now, and that is one of those moments which throws the SS in Buchenwald and elsewhere into a frenzy, because it seems to confirm what the SS has always said about these prisoners, that they are dangerous enemies, lethal enemies of the new order, who have to be held down. I mean, the SS, Eich and others, talk about these prisoners as enemies behind barbed wire. And if there are, in the moment of these events like this escape and murder, the SS sees this confirmed, and they then, in retaliation, as they have it, murder scores of prisoners in Buchenwald and elsewhere.
Nikolaus Waxman is with us, a professor of modern European history at Birkbeck College, University of London. We're talking about his book, KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. We need to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Nikolaus Waxman is with us today. We're talking about his new book, KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. I wanted to ask you about how the Nazis saw work. A lot of these were perceived as, talked about as work camps. And there's one particular story, and there's a number of them, of course, and much of the book is about what it's like for the prisoners day to day to live in a camp like this. And there's this story about, I think, what you describe as the standing commando, in which these prisoners who couldn't work or didn't work were forced to stay on their feet all day inside this hut. So would you just, with that story in mind, give us a sense of this idea?
Well, work is incredibly important to the ideology behind the camp system right from the beginning. In Nazi propaganda, you have to imagine Nazi newspapers and magazines are full of the camps in 1933. Everybody hears and knows about the camp system at that time. And the way the regime presents the camps is as strict but fair re-education camps. And the way the supposed re-education of political opponents is to be carried out is by, the regime claims, getting them used to order and work. There is a long-standing tradition in Nazi thinking and also shared by some other Germans at the time, that those inside the camps who are being pursued are not used to labor. They are lazy. Yeah. The stereotype of Jews or asocials, as they called, as being lazy. And the claim of the regime is that what they're doing is re-educating them through work. What, of course, happens in the camps right from the beginning is that work is used to break, humiliate, and torture prisoners. And this includes early on in the regime completely pointless labor, where people literally shovel sand from one part of the camp to another, or carry stones from one part of the camp to another and then back. What happens later on in the 1930s, in the run-up to war, is that the SS realizes that they've got a resource there they could use in some way. So work now takes on a different function. And that function in the late 1930s is really to use the camps to build these cities, the dream cities which Hitler, the failed architect, had always imagined in his mind. He's forever building and rebuilding German cities. And for that, he needs bricks and stones, and the SS promises to supply those. So a number of those camps which are set up in the run-up to war are camps dedicated to quarries, for example. I mean, Mauthausen and Flossenbürg camps, which are perhaps not as well known, are right next to a number of large quarries.
But how well does that turn out? I mean, you've got emaciated, dying workers trying to make bricks. I mean, how well does that does that turn out for the
predictably disastrous, yeah. Kind of in both both economically, but more importantly, kind of physically for the prisoners.
Yeah.
The most emblematic story here is that of the brickwork which the SS tries to build near Sachsenhausen, which is the new showcase camp of the SS, which they set up in 1936. And the aim there is to build literally the biggest brickwork in the world and show that the SS can really make an economic contribution. And hundreds of prisoners die in the building and rebuilding of these brickworks, which never produce a single brick, because the SS is just technically not able to even carry out the simplest tasks in that sense. I mean, these are largely brawlers and fighters, mm-hmm. Violent men in charge here. These are not SS managers, really, who know how to run such an enterprise. What happens in the war, of course, is then the focus of work shifts eventually towards war production and so on. But even here, the product for the SS, as it were, is really the main product is the death of the prisoners. And that is true throughout the wartime period.
So when does begin? About 1939-41, you say, is when this idea of death really sort of came to be a prominent feature of these camps.
Yes, I mean, there's a huge change early on in the war, and I think that's really important to understand as well. I mean, this precedes the Holocaust entering the concentration camps. With the outbreak of the Second World War, we have, first of all, a pretty swift increase in prisoner numbers. We have a massive spread of disease and illness in these camps, and this has something to do with the growing use of these prisoners as slave laborers, effectively. And what the SS then does, and this is still early on in the war, is that, and that goes back to the standing commander, the question then is what to do with those prisoners who can't work, mm-hmm. who are so exhausted they can't even carry a brick from one end of the camp to another. And so the SS, because they can't bear the idea that any prisoner would be idle in his barrack, comes up in Sachsenhausen with this idea of prisoners just standing for hours and hours and hours at an end. What the SS then moves to, and this is also before the Holocaust, is to think, well, why should we go through the trouble of making these people stand if they're too ill to work? Why don't we just kill them? And this is indeed what they do. So early on in the war, individual SS officials start killing selected so-called invalid prisoners. And that then develops over time into the first systematic killing program in the camps, where doctors' commissions, these are doctors from outside, roam through the camps and pick out several thousand prisoners who are deemed invalid and ill and too sick to work, and they are then shipped to special institutions, asylums, where they are gassed.
Would it be fair to say that the SS and their own incompetence, their own inability to be able to make this system work, led to this inevitable killing? I mean, they're the ones that made them emaciated, obviously. They're the ones that made them inefficient brick makers. And so they ended up killing. I mean, it seems so ironic and so horrible.
The only way around this, I mean, that comes. I talked before about these moments where things don't go along the trajectory you think they go on, and right. Kind of the SS briefly pulls back. One of those moments comes kind of in the middle of the war, where the SS realizes that huge, vast numbers of prisoners die or are executed because they are too ill. And given that labor is becoming an increasingly important resource as the war turns against Germany, the SS does ask itself, well, maybe we should try and improve conditions in a way that not as many prisoners die. But they can't really do this. I mean, there is a brief increase in brief betterment in conditions, and the death rate of registered prisoners falls a little bit. But the whole system doesn't change, because If the SS had wanted to use its prisoners not as expendable slaves but as actual workers, they would have had to change the entire ethos, the spirit of what this camp system was about, and that nobody was willing to contemplate.
One thing you write about is what happens as the Nazi system starts to break down, as the Russians and the Americans approach Berlin, and the war obviously is ending. Hitler and the KL, he kept his distance from the KL and those later. It seems like he seems to have kept his distance throughout his regime, or a good part of it anyway.
Yes, that's true, kind of. And the question is then, why is that the case? And what we do know about Hitler was that he was incredibly concerned with his popular image. I mean, he was riding a wave of popularity in Germany. Even when things weren't going well for the regime, many Germans said, oh, well, but you know, they still believed in Hitler. If only Hitler knew these bad things were going on.
Right.
So Hitler was incredibly careful to cultivate a positive popular image. And he did know that the concentration camps, public as they were not universally popular within Germany. There were, of course, many Germans who supported broadly what happened in the camps, but there were also a number of Germans who looked at the camps with unease or fear or disgust. And Hitler, I think, for that reason, was quite careful. There is no record of him visiting a concentration camp, for example. So he tried to keep his distance to some extent. And that is still true at the very end. It's a very different story as far as Himmler's concerned. I mean, he tries to use the camps at the end as a bargaining chip. I mean, another extraordinary story, trying to sell himself to the Allies, in effect, through secret channels, as a honorable statesman who can be trusted. And what he is saying, in effect, is that he's using the remaining prisoners, in particular Jewish prisoners, as hostages to bargain his way out of what will be a certain death sentence for him.
And even saying, giving orders, issuing orders to stop killing some of the Jews in some of these camps.
Yeah, I mean, there are some orders. I mean, he says he sends his then SS manager of the camp system on a last minute tour of the remaining camps in spring 1945. And I think one of the messages is Himmler wants to pass on to the SS commandants is that they should keep some of the Jews alive because they're his most valuable capital, as it were.
Yeah.
But of course, that doesn't mean that Himmler suddenly thinks that the Holocaust was a mistake, or that the Nazi policy has changed. I mean, this is a last-ditch effort, in a sense, to get himself out of a very tight corner.
You write in the epilogue of your book that liberation was a cathartic moment. And that it would be tempting to end the story there, but of course this wasn't the end of the story. Thousands, hundreds of thousands were so sick, they didn't really understand they were free. And this is something you've talked about profoundly. Would you say something about this moment?
Yeah, it's a kind of, I mean, I think that's a really important point to understand about the camps as well. I mean, there is this, it is a horrible story. It is a heartbreaking story. And there would have been a temptation to at least end this in a cathartic way with the liberation of the camps. And there are photos and testimonies of prisoners embracing each other and cheering and kissing each other and kissing their liberators. And in a sense, that might have been an ending for this book. But the more I thought about this, the more important it became to me to show that this is not the end of the story, and the camps don't end with liberation, in a sense, because thousands, I mean, I estimate about up to 30,000 survivors die within the first days and weeks after liberation. This is perhaps about 10% of those who were liberated, as it were. So they are liberated only to die within days or weeks. And even if they survive these early weeks, I mean, what kind of lives will they lead? I mean, they face trauma, huge persistent health problems. Many Jewish prisoners have no families or homes to go back to. There's the terrible issue of compensation, where survivors literally have to beg the German authorities to have some kind of pensions, and many of them are turned away. At the same time, there is the question of what happens to these perpetrators. And we come back to Oskar Gröning, who was in the news today. Most of these perpetrators, meanwhile, get away with murder or with being accomplices to murder. There is a study for former Auschwitz staff which estimates that no more than 15% of those who served in Auschwitz at one time come before a court after 1945. So the great majority of them are never judged by a judge or by a jury. So this is part of this story of the camps as well, it seems to me.
You mentioned that there were so many who just wanted to erase the camps from their mind. You mentioned one particular story, Shlomo Dragon, who said, I just want to return to a normal life and forget everything I experienced. So there's that impulse, wanting to forget. And then there's, of course, the profound desire to sort of give testimony and remember.
I think that's really important as well, because there is this, if we talked about myths surrounding the camps, I mean, I think one of these images in the minds of many people is that there is a silence after the war, and that it takes decades for survivors to speak. And that is, of course, true for some, but many others leave the camps burning to tell their story. And that's one of the things I was perhaps most surprised about in my research, just how many testimonies there are given in the first days, weeks, and months after liberation. During their imprisonment, many prisoners, one of the things that kept prisoners going in a sense was the wish to survive, to testify, both in order to bring the guilty to justice and also as a to commemorate those of their comrades who did not survive. So this urge to testify is incredibly strong amongst many, and there are literally thousands of testimonies from the very early period of post-liberation. And one of the things I try to do is to pull these different, or as many of those testimonies as possible, into my history of the KL, of the concentration camps.
Less than a minute left. This may not be a fair question with such little time remaining, but I did wonder, what effect did this have on you? Are you okay? Because it would be, would be traumatic, I think, to look at these stories, you know, day after day after day.
Well, I mean, kind of, I don't think, I'm not sure at the moment if I'm going to write another book over 10 years on a similar topic. So we'll have to see. But, you know, I mean, I think the real challenge here was to try and tell this story in an engaging and interesting way. And that is something which I hope I've managed to do.
Nikolaus Waxman, his new book is called KL, A History of the Nazi Concentration Camps. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in Liverpool. Professor, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Our thanks to Braden Child. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.